News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And on our show today, Christy, we're going to be talking with Dr. Dan Ariely about the health of defying logic.
Should be a fascinating conversation. I'm looking forward to it, Adam.
He's a world-famous psychologist, behavioral economist over at Duke University, and be really interesting. But first, we've got some really interesting, probably health of defying logic research that matters out there.
The first one is about breaking up with a boyfriend or girlfriend, about losing love and how it affects the brain.
Yeah. Have you ever been jolted by a lover? Let's be honest here.
Sure, I have, but I don't remember it, partly because of the research here that as time goes on, you start to forget all of that.
Well,
I remember it.
I was jolted by a lover. Come on, you can say, but
somebody broke your heart.
Same time more than once. But you know what? I got over it. As you said, I got over it. And why is it that I got over it? This research tells us.
It does. This is research that looked at the brains of what they call the brains of the lovelorn. So brains of people who've been rejected by a romantic partner and looked to see what areas light up in the brain when they look with an MRI, and found that there are parts of the brain similar to the ones that light up with addiction, reward, craving, and depression that light up in these people.
Yeah, you know, this was published in the Journal of Neurophysiology, and it was 15 university-age men and women who had been jilted by their partners, but they said they were absolutely and very, very intensely in love, and they had been in relationships about 2 years, and only 2 months had passed since one of them called it quits.
And as they looked at the MRIs, they found that the areas of the brain, it was very interesting how similar it was when they lit up looking at the people, at pictures of their romantic partners, to see how that compared with areas of addiction and craving, really showing that you crave the person who broke up with you.
Yeah, and what happened after you break up, they found that the neurotransmitter dopamine kind of flooded the brain, and it led these people to feel desperation, which can also lead to things like depression, stalking, homicide, and even suicide.
But just as we were mentioning earlier, Adam, it did show that the greater the number of days since that rejection, the less the activity showed up in the brain area associated with attachment. So time does heal.
Well, you know, Christy, I have a friend whose son was in a relationship just like this, and it was exceedingly difficult when they broke up. And, you know, one of the things I take home from this is that falling out of love is a learning process. And when this breakup, it really does have to be taken seriously, in that it may be should be treated like an addiction, and that what you should do maybe is, you know, you really have to separate. You can't continue a relationship or dabble with it.
So put away the photos, throw away the old love cards, and really put it aside so you have time to heal.
Get exercise to replenish that dopamine.
The next one is about a term that I wasn't even aware of until I read this article, but cyber bullies and their victims and what sort of relationships that has to a person's emotional state.
Yeah, you know, this was research that was in the Archives of General Psychiatry. And, you know, our children increasingly are really cyber children. They have computers and they have cell phones and they have Skype and they have Facebook and they have Twitter accounts. They have multiple ways of communicating through cyberspace with other children. And they say everything about themselves.
Well, and children can be mean to one another. And cyberbullying is when a minor or child uses technology as a weapon to hurt another person. So it may not be a weapon, you know, like a bat or a gun, but a weapon that can really cause emotional discomfort or those feelings of being hurt.
Like saying you're really stupid, you're really ugly, or something much more insidious, putting
a picture.
Face of this person on the naked body of someone else and posting that online to really humiliate someone.
Right, really mean things. And this was a study of over 2,000 Finnish teenagers age 13 to 16, and about 5% of them said that they were victimized by cyberbullies. About 7% admitted to doing it, and a little over 5% said they had both been cyberbullies and had been bullied by someone else in this way.
Yeah, and the victims had really emotional problems, concentration, attention problems, behavioral problems, headaches, stomach pain, difficulty sleeping, feeling unsafe at school. It's really, I mean, those are really bad things. We've heard reports, of course, of kids committing suicide who have been victims of cyberbullying.
Right. And the interesting part about this for me is that the people who were doing the bullying also reported emotional difficulties, problems with concentration and behavior, and difficulty getting along with other people. And they were more likely to be hyperactive, have conduct problems, alcohol use, and smoke cigarettes. And they also had frequent headaches and feeling unsafe at school. So it seemed like wherever you were involved in it, it can affect you.
So if you have children out there, and I have children and teenagers, you know, have a conversation. You know, what do they do when this happens? You know, you have to stop it, you have to block it, and you have to tell someone about it. You don't respond and get into this tit-for-tat sort of thing.
Right, but don't respond at all and have a safe place where you can talk about it. So these are definitely important issues for us to pay attention to with our children.
Well, our very next research that matters actually is still on this theme of adolescence and the question of TV and video games, what they're doing to children's attention spans. We know things like attention deficit disorder are serious issues that lots of kids have.
And we've known that watching excessive television has been associated with attention problems for kids. But this was one of the first studies to look at video games and really draw similar conclusions.
Yeah, this is in the journal Pediatrics. 1,300 students that were in the third, fourth, and fifth grades over a year period looking at their exposure to the TV and these video games and the attention problems reported by the teachers, as well as also looking at college students who talked about how much video game play and TV and their attention problems.
And they found that exposure to TV and video games was linked to greater attention problems, and that the college students showed similar associations, suggesting that TV or video game exposure may have longer lasting consequences than just the immediate consequences in childhood.
Christy, let me ask you, were you ever kind of like addicted to a video game? Did you ever
Play?
You know, one of the things I found from this, and this goes way back to even the days before video games, we had this little soccer thing, it's called foosball, and I'd play it for hours at a time, is after doing something for a long, like an hour straight, you stop it, but I remember parts of my brain were still thinking about it, particularly if I try to go to sleep or play online chess for a couple hours, then you try to go to sleep, and I found
I was still thinking about
the chess. And I wonder if there's this process going on in all of us who do these things, that in our kids in particular with these video games, that it continues haunting them in some ways. They keep thinking about it, ruminating.
Well, and the other part of it is that the TV shows and video games tend to be very fast-moving with lots of exciting things, and so maybe then it's harder for kids to focus on
reading their homework or something.
Boring. Exactly. My daughter's already learned that word. Mommy, that's boring.
Well, this is a serious issue. This isn't an answer, but where I think we draw this research that says, huh, there's real reason to be concerned about it. And our last one is the good news of today.
It is. This is a study looking at later start times for high school students and its relationship to mood and motivation.
You know, here in Orange County, at the high schools, they do start the schools at 8:45. And there's now research here that says that this simple delay like that actually has tremendous health benefits for our teens. I was dubious. I'm impressed. I've changed my mind.
I have, too. This is a study of 200 students in high school in Rhode Island, where they changed the start time for school from 8 to 8:30 for a two-month period. And they surveyed them before and after, and they found pretty remarkable things. Like the percentage of students getting less than 7 hours of sleep per night dropped by almost 80%.
Yeah, those getting at least 8 hours of sleep at night increased threefold, up to 54% after 2 months.
A percentage of students who reported feeling annoyed or irritated or unhappy or depressed also dropped remarkably.
And those who had to go to a health center because they were tired actually decreased from 15% to 4.5%. This seems like this was in the Archives of Pediatric and Adolescent Medicine, if any of our listeners want to go hear it. But it's a great study, important work. I'm convinced now, particularly for our older children, this is the right thing to do. We should not be, and even college, we shouldn't probably force our college students to take 8 o'clock classes.
Sure.
That's inhumane.
I mean, it's adjusting the school schedule to their circadian rhythm, which does make sense.
Yeah, well, that probably concludes our research that matters, but we've talked about starting school later. It's a benefit for teens and maybe even a lot of others.
We've talked about TV and video game overload, potentially hurting kids' attention span.
Being on the alert for cyber bullies and the logic of intervening.
And a little bit about losing love and its similarities in the brain to addiction.
Well, that's going to conclude Research That Matters. We'll take a short break. When we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Dan Ariely about the health of defying logic. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, we're going to be talking about the health of defying logic, or why do we make decisions that sometimes don't appear to be in our own best interest? And we have a great guest today, Christy.
Yes, we'd like to welcome Dr. Dan Ariely. Dr. Ariely is the James B. Duke Professor of Psychology and Behavioral Economics at Duke University, with appointments at the Duke Business School, the Center for Cognitive Neurosciences, the Department of Economics, and the School of Medicine. He earned one PhD in cognitive psychology from UNC and another PhD in business administration from Duke University, so splits his two color blues. He works, his work has been featured in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, the Boston Globe. I can really go on and on with a variety of places that his work has been published, and he has appeared on CNN and on numerous media sites, including National Public Radio's Marketplace. He is the author of the New York Times bestseller Predictably Irrational and the follow-up book The Upside of Irrationality, The Unexpected Benefits of Defying Logic and at Work and at Home is the book we're going to talk about today. So we'd like to welcome you, Dr. Ariely.
My pleasure. This turned out to be a long introduction.
Well, I had to cut it out. I had to cut it down. There was so much to say about you.
Well, we're thrilled. We're going to jump right in, Dr. Ariely. Tell us, you know, you're a behavioral economist, and I think for a lot of our listeners out there, you know, I know that you observe how people behave. How do you describe that to people?
So, you know, behavioral economics is a field that is kind of between psychology and economics. And what is most important about it is that, unlike economics, which make assumptions about how people should behave if they were perfectly rational, behavioral economics has no beliefs about how people should behave. Instead, we just put people in different situations, we observe how they behave, and because what we find is often different than what we assume people, how we assume people would behave, we actually have different, very different prescriptions of how we should design, for example, the healthcare system.
Well, you say that human beings are irrational. How does that work? Because that's the title of your book, The Upside of Irrationality.
Yeah. So first of all, what does it mean, irrational? There's lots of definition of irrationality. The one that I care most about is that we don't exactly understand the reasons that we make different decisions. So, for example, imagine that you take people and you ask them, do they want to be on a diet? You know, and most people said, I want to observe my weight, I want to be a bit careful, maybe I want to lose a few pounds. And then you put them in a restaurant and you get the waiter to come and offer them chocolate souffle. And let's just imagine for a second that it's warm chocolate souffle and you can smell the chocolate. What happened
good.
In that moment is that most people changed their opinions. They said, yes, diet is good, but maybe next week, and right now chocolate is really, really wonderful. This is a case in which, judging way up front, you say to yourself, I can resist temptation. I'm not really interested in chocolate. Long-term goals are more important. But then when your emotion is hit, your temptation increases, and you start craving chocolate, you become a different person. And that's kind of one kind of trap that we get ourselves into. We think that we could resist temptation. It turns out we're really not good at it. And when the time comes, we often fail.
And so the hope in understanding this better is that then we can help people achieve that self-control or achieve the goals. I think you mentioned that your goal is to help humans find more compassionate, realistic, and effective ways to avoid temptation, exert more self-control, and reach their long-term goals. Are you successful in achieving this, and how do you measure that?
Well, so, you know, I can't claim success. There's so many ways
we're
tempted.
Well, the more people that read your book, Dr. Early, I guess maybe that'll be a measure of success.
But, yeah, so on that level I've been very successful. But, you know, the hope is to make some steps toward this goal, and I don't think I want to even imagine that we'll achieve it completely. But the issue is that if you understand where we fail, we can also think about how we move forward. So I'll give you some examples about medical adherence. And I start this book, The Upside of Irrationality, by talking about my particular struggle with medical adherence with a medication called interferon. And for me, this was kind of a very strong case of this conundrum between now and later. Because interferon could, in principle, really help me overcome some of my liver problems and make sure that I don't die from liver cirrhosis, in principle, many years later. But what it did for sure is to make me miserable for about 16 hours after every time I took the injection. So here I was with this injection facing a question between, do I do it for the long term or do I kind of skip this one medication and have a good evening? And I had to give myself these medications 3 times a week for a year and a half.
And most people would not be able to do what you were able to accomplish, correct?
That's right. So empirically, I was the only patient in this FDA protocol that did it. And it's not, by the way, because I have better self-control, or I'm kind of an angel, or I understand my long-term future better. I mean, I'm as susceptible as everybody else. But in this particular case, I invented a trick for myself. And my trick was the following. I knew that this force of something good about 30 years later is not going to be powerful enough. So I substituted it. We call it reward substitution. Every time I took the injection, I did something I really love, which is I love watching movies. So I would take the injection, and I would start watching a movie immediately, actually 2 or 3 movies.
So
that
an
I really
immediate
wanted.
Reward.
That's right. And an hour later, I would get sick, and I would get the side effects, you know, vomiting and shaking, a headache. But the immediate thing I connected the injection to was to something good. And that sustained me in this path to being able to continue taking the medication on time. Now, you know, this is a very peculiar solution. It's about me and movies and so on. Now we're trying to figure out other reward substitutions. We're trying to think about what else could we get people to do for their health care. So you're saying, can we get people to care about what will happen 30 years later? And the answer is it's very unlikely. It's very hard that we could give people... very hard to imagine we could give people a lecture about what will happen to their health 10, 20, 30 years later, and that they will all of a sudden change their ways. But if we could find other things that would be rewarding and will be connected to good behavior, maybe we could get people to behave as if they care about their long-term objective. So we're trying this in all kinds of ways. We're saying, what if we posted your medical adherence to Facebook? What if we told... your mother or your kids when you're not taking the medication? What if we offer people some money for taking it? Turns out offering some money doesn't help very much. But what about if we took money away from people if they didn't take the medication on time? That turns out to be much more successful.
We were talking with Dr. Dan Ariely about his book, The Upside of Irrationality. And Dr. Ariely, I just wanted to interject to ask, I guess in your situation, it was the one thing that really affected you about something you loved, which being movies, and maybe we could work to tailor that for patients with chemotherapy or other things for that single thing that would affect the one patient. But you're thinking more globally on a population level of what we can do that maybe would be attractive to everyone to make those decisions.
Yeah, I mean, ideally we could find out different things that work for different people better, but I'm first of all trying to find out what are some general solutions that seems to be working. Right, so... think about something like Ulysses and the Sirens. So Ulysses knew that when the sirens would sing, he would be tempted, so he tied himself to the mast. That requires a lot of forethinking, and it requires math, and it requires some rope. The question is, can we help people kind of come up with their own Ulysses solutions? Can we provide people ropes and mast and different ideas and proposals and let people overcome it? Because the truth is that lots of people understand that they fail. And when they're calm and in a non-aroused, non-emotional state of mind, they want to do better. The question is, can we offer them tools at that moment that will do that? And they could be very small tools. I mean, for example, have you seen these 100-calorie cookie packs?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, sure.
Right? This is a really nice idea, right? It says, I know that if I open a big bag, I'll eat lots of cookies. So let's give people small bags. And people are, by the way, paying a lot of money for these small bags compared to the big bags.
Sure.
But it might be that it's actually helpful, that you say to yourself, okay, I'll just open one. And it delineates very clearly when you're going to stop. So we're looking for lots and lots of those small mechanisms that could just help push people to behave slightly better. But if we have a lot of them, people might actually end up behaving much better.
Well, we're gonna need a short break, but we're talking with Dr. Dan Ariely, and I know in your book, Dr. Ariely, you say that irrationality helps us to adopt to new environments, and you describe one of your struggles, and you're talking about medical adherence, but you also talk about much the whole human condition, about trust among people, about the enjoyment of work, about love and families and relationships. And I know after the break, we're going to really want to talk about some of these applications of your work to chronic diseases and to relationships between people, because this is what we do as family physicians, and I know our listeners are interested. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Dan Ariely. We'll be right back with UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Dan Ariely about his book, The Upside of Irrationality, The Unexpected Benefits of Defying Logic at Work and at Home. And Dr. Ariely, one of the things we love to talk about this segment is about the applicability of your work to chronic disease and particularly with pain. And I know you've shared a bit about your own experience with pain. And we wondered if you'd tell us about how what you've learned about how previous experience with pain relates to future experience and how this applies to people with chronic pain.
Yeah, so this perhaps was the first experiment I did in kind of social science. And when I was in hospital for about 3 years, and when I left, I went to study at the university. And one of my professors, the professor of physiology of the brain, was a guy called Professor Frank. And he lost both of his legs in the explosion on the landmine when he was in the army. And he kind of turned his interest and personal experience of pain into his profession, and he became a pain researcher. And because I took his class and because we shared so much in common, we were in the same hospital with some of the same nurses and doctors, and we would often stop and talk about our painful experiences. And one day I came to his office and I said, I told him that I just went to the dentist for the first time since I got out of hospital. And it was interesting because I didn't take Novocaine. And I said, I know, they were drilling and I could feel the pain, but somehow I didn't care so much about it. It was hurting, but I didn't care about it. And he said that he had the same thing, that he got injured about 20 years earlier, but in those 20 years he never took Novocaine. He described the same type of experience where he felt the pain but didn't care about it. And we decided to do an experiment on this. And next to the university, this was in Israel, was one of these army country clubs. So these were people with all kinds of army injury that would just come to this club to swim and play sports and do arts and crafts and all kinds of things. So we set up a little lab there. We went to the infirmary and we set a little tub with hot water, and we asked people to put their hand up to their elbow in this hot water and keep it there for as long as they could. And when they couldn't stand it any longer, to take it out. And this was kind of a measure of how much pain they could tolerate. And we got lots of people to come and do that. And when they finished, we took their medical files to the hospital where Professor Frank and I used to be patients in. And we asked the doctors and some of the nurses to catalog the patients into two groups, a group that kind of did not experience really strong injuries and a group that had very strong injuries. And then we compared the pain tolerance in those two groups. And what happened was that people had strong injuries were tolerating much, much more pain. So this was kind of the first point that Professor Frank and I were not kind of just strange. It turns out that there is something about experiencing pain for a long duration that makes people like him and I a bit more resilient.
And you had significant burns over three quarters of your body from a traumatic injury. I don't necessarily think our listeners have know this. You talk about it in your book freely, so I just want to make sure that people understand that your experience was a very painful experience over many, many years.
Yeah, burns are incredibly, incredibly painful. Right? There's the burns themselves, and then there's the process of bandage removal and physiotherapy, and every time that they move a limb which is burned so badly, it's incredibly painful.
So you talk about this adaptation to pain. And you also talk about there's something about a hope of getting better there. How do you see your work then in this adaptation? How does it relate to those who have chronic diseases, like chronic pain, but other chronic diseases in terms of their experience of the disease and maybe how medical professionals might approach management?
Yeah, so you know, we had two people in the set that had chronic diseases. They're not big enough to make conclusions about, but I'll tell you what it is and some of my thoughts. So these were two people that, unlike everybody else just got a kind of an acute injury like me. You get injured once and then you get better. And we had two people who came with chronic pain, somebody with some intestinal problems, somebody else with a type of cancer. And originally I didn't want to test those people because they were not the kind of injuries we were interested in. On the other hand, I didn't want to, you know, also hurt them for no good reason, but you know, I didn't know what to do. But anyway, eventually I tested them. And it turns out that those two people had a pain tolerance that was lowest than everybody else in the experiment. And, you know, again, this is not a big group, of course. It's only two people. We shouldn't make conclusion from it. But what it makes me suspect is that for people like me, pain is usually associated with getting better. I mean, there's a lot of pain from the injury, but pain is particularly bad under treatments and physical therapy and bandage removal and operations and all of those things. So it gets some kind of positive association. Whereas for the two people we had with the chronic injury, pain was just associated with getting worse, with dying. It was a signal of things are just going worse and things are not getting better. And I think that's actually quite important. This idea that pain is a signal that our brain gets, but it's a lot about the interpretation of the signal, not just the signal itself. And if you could get people to interpret it in a more positive way, you can not feel less pain, but you can care less about it. And now, of course, the question is, how do we take people who have chronic injury, and how do we get them to have more of this benefit of people with acute injuries, like me have, rather than the people who have really bad chronic injuries? So how do you get people to feel that this pain is not a signal of things going worse, that it could actually be a signal of things getting better? How do you get people to feel that they can conquer the pain, that it's not as negative as they're experiencing? And I don't have a good answer for this, but I think this is kind of the direction, is to think about pain not just as the physical transmission of nerve signal, but think about how the people are interpreting it. And can we help people reinterpret it in more positive ways?
Well, you know, I think it's important because you talk about throughout your book, you talk about, and you're relating just now, experiments combined with experience to come up with new observations. We're talking with Dr. Dan Ariely in his new book, The Upside of Irrationality, The Unexpected Benefits of Defying Logic at Work and at Home. And I wonder if you could, in the remaining minutes, talk about one or two things, and then also where we can get your copy of your book for our listeners. But you talk about this adaptation again, and this experience, how it might relate to people who maybe drink a lot and derive pleasure. And you talk about slowing down pleasure, which would perhaps have some relationship to addictions like alcohol. Can you talk about that for a second?
Yeah, so adaptation is both good and bad, and that's kind of one version of the upside of irrationality. When bad things happen, like a real bad injury like mine, you think you will be miserable for a really long time, and you're really miserable, but for shorter time than you think. Sooner or later, you'll get adapted to it. Not fully, but life will go on, and you'll find other pleasure in life. So, you know, if I look at my own life, I wouldn't have imagined that I would find so much pleasure in life out of that. I mean, I still regret my injury. I wish it didn't happen. I still have pain. But it's not as bad as I would have thought. It wasn't for not as long as time. I mean, it was really bad, but not for as long as time. The same thing happens on the positive side. When good things happen, you know, you buy a new car, you get married, you know, you have kids, you think this will be really wonderful for a really long time. It turns out it's really wonderful for a much shorter period of time. And soon enough, you get used to it. You buy a new car, you think, oh, I'll really be happy for a long time. You're happy for 3 weeks, and then it goes away. So adaptation has this kind of positive and negative side to it. And the question, of course, is what can we do about it? How can we maybe accelerate adaptation for things that are bad and slow it down for things that are good? Because it will be really nice to not adapt to good things. And what's interesting here is that stopping experiences actually helps a lot to slow down adaptation. So if you have a long and experience is prolonged and you break it into pieces, it turns out adaptation slows down, and that can either be good or bad. So think about something really good, like having a massage or swimming in a hot tub or something really fun, and you say, do you want to take a break? And people say, no, I just want to go to do it continuously. And then you think about something negative, like doing your taxes, and you say, do you want to take a break? And say, of course I want to take breaks. It's so wonderful to take breaks. But what people don't understand is that if you take a break, you come back to a different experience. So if it was something good, this something good becomes less good over time. And if you take a break, while the break itself is unpleasant, coming back to the experience, you come back to a more pleasant experience. So when you have pleasurable experience, ironically, it's really good to take breaks.
So how do you apply that to your car? So, your car story? Just drive someone else's, drive your spouse's car for a little while, for a day or two,
right,
to break
switch,
it up.
Switch with your spouse every 4 days.
And for young,
and for young
teens or people who are drinking too much, clearly abstinence or a period of abstinence can break that cycle and remove perhaps this pleasurable stimulus.
Yeah, so you know, with addictive substances, actually, particularly with cigarettes, right? With cigarettes, there's a critical period. For people who don't smoke for a while, a cigarette can become repulsive. Mm-hmm. The question is, can you stop it for long enough to be repulsive? With alcohol, it's the same thing, in the sense that if you have your first glass of alcohol is really fun, the second one is okay, the third one is less fun, and they become less and less fun. So if you think about, imagine you have some kind of amount of alcohol you're willing to consume. The question is, how do you want to space it over time? And if you'll space it over time to a larger degree, you'll actually create more pleasure out of it. So I think there's, if you understand kind of how pleasure and pain kind of dissipates over time, then you can start to think about how you overcome that. And for example, it means, I think, that if you think that a sofa, that buying a new sofa and going on a vacation will give you the same pleasure, you should probably do the vacation. Why? Because the sofa will make you happy for a short time, and the vacation will actually give you something that you can't adapt to it because it's short and fleeting. You don't actually adapt to it. So there's a question of what experiences do we invest in. And I think we don't invest enough in transient experiences, and we overinvest in fixed experiences, and because our system is built the way it is, it actually backfires.
Well, I know we've had having you on our show is a transient experience that we're benefiting from and loving immensely. But I know we're going to have to wrap up, and we can't wait to get another book written because we need to get you back on the show. But where can our listeners easiest place to get a copy of your book, Upside of Irrationality?
So I have a website called danarielly.com, and Ariely is a hard name to spell, so it's A-R-I-E-L-Y.
So Dan Ariely, A-R-I-E-L-Y.com.
Yep. I have a blog, and I have videos that describe different chapters of the book, and I have and people can get lots of material. In addition, there's a link to my book. But you know, I think it's kind of really interesting to think about our own nature. And what I hope that people would do with this material is kind of not just read it and say, hey, aren't other people crazy or interesting or odd, but actually use it as a mirror. Here's some behavior. Let's look at ourselves through that and see maybe there's something we need to think about or change or modify.
Well, that is great advice. And we can't thank you enough for being with us today and for sharing your book with us.
My pleasure.
We've been talking with Dr. Dan Ariely, author of The Upside of Irrationality, The Unexpected Benefits of Defying Logic at Work and at Home. We're going to need to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to talk about your health questions, your experiences, and your attitudes towards medical care.
You can write us with your own experiences and questions. We will address them on an upcoming show. Send them to yourhealth@unc.edu. Better yet, even call us at 966-8081. And we'd like to ask our executive producer, Julie Steiner, to read us our very first house call.
Our first listener asks, what kind of doctor do I see for leg cramps? My legs hurt all the time, and I'm worried I have something I saw in a magazine, PAD.
That is a great, great question. And there are a couple questions in there. The first is, which kind of doctor to see?
Well, I'd say see a good one.
Yes.
See someone who knows a little bit about legs and leg cramps, which is most primary care doctors should know this.
It is. And I would say that could be your general internal medicine doctor or your family doctor. But whoever is your main primary care doctor, that's the place to start.
Yeah. And, you know, it also, one of the first questions we're going to know is, do you smoke or not? If you don't smoke, I'm a little bit less concerned about potential PAD, which is peripheral arterial disease, clots of cholesterol and other clots in the legs that's linked to smoking. It could be other things as well, but I'm a little bit less concerned about that.
Sure. I feel like we talked about PAD at some point, but the most common symptoms for that are cramping with exercise or stairs that then goes away when you rest, something called claudication is the fancy word
for it. Yeah, if your legs are hurting all the time, there may be something else going on here, and it's, you know, we'd worry about your medications and a lot of other kinds of questions here. But you know what? We're going to agree on one thing.
Go see your primary care doctor.
Go see your primary care doctor.
Okay, Julie, what do we have next?
I have Parkinson's disease, and I recently saw a medical report about bicycling being really beneficial for such people. Is it true?
You know, it's really interesting. I saw this same research. I didn't look at it in detail, but there was some really interesting research, and surprising to me that people's symptoms got better, I think, when they were bicycling. Did you see this, Christy?
I did. I saw it was research from the Cleveland Clinic, I believe, and I don't have the details, but it was something about tandem biking. So not just biking on their own, but being pushed to exercise even more than they would have maybe on their own.
It wasn't like doing it with someone else, the tandem portion of it, you know, the company.
Right.
It was a real exercise.
Real exercise. And doing it for 1 hour, 3 times per week. And they had a decrease in tremors and other symptoms by about 35% compared with the people who were just exercising on their own. So,
yeah, you know, I have a patient who actually with Parkinson's who talked with me about this, Christy, and she also is really trying to get up a movement group for people with Parkinson's. So dance and exercise, and it's really opened up this kind of whole world to me of how important exercise is to maintaining, if not improving, Parkinson's.
There is some information about this on the Michael J. Fox Foundation website as well, if you're interested.
Well, that's wonderful. So thank you for bringing this to our attention and we can bring it to our listeners' attention. What's our very next house call, Julie?
My doctor recently recommended that I get a pedometer to increase my physical activity. I got one, and it counts the number of steps I take a day. What is the right number for someone like me? A pretty healthy, though overweight, 46-year-old woman.
Well, congratulations.
Yeah, good
not
for
being,
you.
Not on being overweight, but getting a pedometer and wanting to do something about being overweight. That's great.
That's a big step. And once you start wearing that thing, you really do start paying more attention to how much you're walking.
You know, we were just in Europe with my family, and I had this little pedometer, and we were going to do a little bit of walking each day. And it got to be this thing, Christy, where we shared, all the kids wanted to wear the pedometer for a day. And we averaged 12,000 steps a day, and our highest was almost 19,000 steps one day.
Wow,
that's a lot of walking, isn't it?
That is. So a general goal you hear on a lot of the different campaigns for this is $10,000 a day.
$10,000 steps. $10,000 would be really nice.
I'd like to get paid
$10,000
for my steps. But 10,000 steps a day, and that's what's considered active. Less than 5,000 is considered having a sedentary lifestyle.
For this, our listener here, that might be enough, because you might be only getting 2,000 right now, so get to 5,000 is a good starting place.
Sure. So I would take, first find out what are you doing on average in your normal lifestyle, and then add to that. And one strategy is to add 2,000 to that to prevent any further weight gain, and add more than that, but do it gradually in order to try to lose weight.
Yeah, I found it amazing. I played like 20 minutes of tennis, and I did 2,000 steps in 20 minutes. It just shows you some activities, how much running and movement you do versus just kind of your normal, regular activity. Great question. Thank you very much.
Good for you for taking charge.
What's our very last house call?
I've had a small lymph node, that's what my doctors call it, under the skin of my neck for 3 years. It hasn't gotten much bigger. It's about the size of my thumbnail. It's firm and does not hurt at all. While my doctors reassure me it's okay, I still worry about it. What do you think?
Well, I say thank you again for writing, and this is again one that I'd love to have some more information. Your age, are there any other? It sounds like no other associated symptoms, like losing weight or having changes in your voice. And I'd want to know, do you smoke? Because that would be significant. Generally, if it's not changing in months to years, it's probably not a growing cancer or something, but it's hard for me to say that without more information.
Yeah, this is one of those ones where I'm going to say, Christy, that the doctors are right, but the patient's also right. I mean, your doctors are reassuring you, but you're still worrying. And the fact, even though someone's reassuring you, maybe you've got someone in your family that died of a cancer that people got reassured about, and yet it turned out to be cancer later down the road. So, you know what? It's really easy potentially sometimes just to have this taken out or have a small needle put into it. I mean, so, you know, how reassured do you need to be as a listener or as a patient before you're not going to worry about it? And if you can keep worrying about it, maybe just have it taken out. I don't know.
Sure. And at least go back to your doctor and say, okay, explain to me all the reasons why you're not worried about this. And should I get an ultrasound or any sort of image of it or get a biopsy of it? And just have that conversation very openly with your doctor that you are worried, because, I mean, that the worry itself can cause problems too.
Yeah. Yep. Well, hopefully we've been able to talk about some really important house calls about maybe either getting more information or either taking something out if it really bothers you.
About the use of a pedometer to walk more and lose weight.
At least 5,000, moving to 10,000 steps a day.
About Parkinson's disease and the benefits of bicycling.
Yeah, lots of exercise. And actually, even we didn't talk about this with leg cramps, but we probably should have, which is what you should do for leg cramps if it's not arterial disease, maybe even if it is, which is exercise and stretching can help out leg cramps in almost any cause.
That is true. Thank you for writing us, and thank you for joining us today for Your Health. We hope we've addressed some issues and concerns that are important to you and to your health, and we want you to write us. Email us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Again, that's yourhealth@unc.edu, or call us at 919-966-8081. You can also visit us online at yourhealthradio.org and follow us on Twitter by going to twitter.com and searching for Your Health Radio.
We'd like to thank WCHL, the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, our great producer, Julie Steiner, and our guest today, Dr. Dan Ariely. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of the UNC Department of Family Medicine, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
We'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. You can also go to our website, 1360WCHL.com, and click on WCHL On Demand. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360 WCHL.